Hello, good day to you. My name is Edmonton Anulochu. This is LawDio, Public International Law. Let's go straight to business and talk about subjects of international law. Now, for every legal system, we have law. The institutions to make and enforce the law, and then the subjects of those laws. The same situation is with international law. We have the institutions, the law itself, then we have subjects of international law. So under subjects, we mean entities capable of possessing an international right, an international obligation, and have the right or the capacity to bring an international claim to enforce its right. Now, there are elements an entity must satisfy to be considered a subject of international law. What are these elements? One, it must have international rights provided for under a treaty or international customary law. Two, must have international duties or obligations imposed on it under a treaty or customary international law. Three, must have the capacity to bring international claims arising from treaties or customary international law. So we are saying that for an entity to be a subject of international law, one, it must have rights. Two, it must have duties. Then three, it must have capacity to bring claims arising from treaties or customary international law. Now, there are various subjects of international law, but we'll deal with five. One, states. Two, intergovernmental organizations. Three, individuals. Four, sui generis entities. Five, transnational companies. Now, let's deal with states. A state is a community of persons living within certain limits of territory under a permanent organization which aims to secure the prevalence of justice by self-imposed law. And the organ of state by which it relates with other states are managed by a government. Okay? So, we are saying that a state is a community of persons living within a certain limit of territory. Then it has a government and then a population of people. Now, so per Article 1 of the Montevideo Convention on Rights and Duties of States, 1933, for an entity to qualify as a state, it must possess the following attributes. One, a permanent population. Two, a defined territory. Three, a government. Then four, capacity to enter into international relations. So it must be noted that the criteria for determining statehood is different from the criteria for determining subjects of international law. So to determine a subject of international law, you must, one, have duty, a right, and a capacity to bring claims. Then statehood, to determine statehood, is a permanent population, a defined territory, a government, and a capacity to enter into international relations. So we see a cross-cutting theme of capacity between statehood and a subject of international law. So both states and subjects need to have the capacity to enter into international relations, which is the doctrine of sovereignty. Okay, now a permanent population means that it doesn't mean that there are people always there, but they can be traveling in and out, but it has a particular number of individuals occupying a certain geographical area. So the nomadic population, like the Jews, were not considered as a state since they did not form a stable community. It must be noted that there is no requirement for the number of people that must come to form a stable community. It could be 2 people, it could be 100 people, it could be 200 people. So Nigeria's population is about 211.4 million people, right? But somewhere like Equatorial Guinea has about 1.27 million people, but they are both states. Okay, so now let's say, let's move on to a defined territory. So the state must be found on the path of a globe. It must be able to be captured on a globe. It must have defined borders. Okay, the borders must be defined, but it does not necessarily mean that every border must be settled and without any dispute. So there could be dispute, but the borders are defined. So there has to be at least a clear demarcation of the boundaries indicating the land, sea, and air territory separating them. Okay, so Israel up to date has still some border disputes with Palestine, but it is nonetheless recognized as a state. So it doesn't mean that because there's a border dispute, there's no state. Now, Albania before the First World War, despite its numerous border disputes, was recognized as a state. So, but however, the state of Palestine declared in November 1988 at a conference in Algiers could not be regarded as a state because the Palestinian organization or government did not control any part of the territory they claimed. So it must also be noted that there must not necessarily be a link between all the territorial borders of the state. For example, Alaska and USA are far between each other, but they are all part of the USA. Okay, now let's move to a government. Now, a government is an organization through which a body of people exercise political authority or the machinery by which sovereign power is exercised. Now, there has to be a stable political organization in control of the territory, and that political organization must enjoy obedience from a greater percentage of the nation. The court held in the Ireland case, Ireland is Ireland case, that the Republic of Finland, in the legal sense, became a state when a stable political organization had been created and the authorities had become strong enough to assert themselves through the territories of the state without external interference. Now, the state must also have a government, and it does not matter how the government comes about or the form of government practiced in such a state. It could be a monarchical government, like in Saudi Arabia, military government, like wars in Ghana, whichever. The only requirement is the government must be legitimate, it must be stable and accepted by majority of the population to be effective. Now let's look at capacity to enter into international relations. Under this requirement, the state must first be legally independent, an aspect of state sovereignty. Independence was explained by Judge Huber as the right to exercise therein, to the exclusion of any other state, the functions of a state. This was elucidated in the Island of Palmas case. It may also be described as sovereignty, by which it is meant that the state has over it no other authority than that of international law. That is, the state should not be under any control of any other superior or external body, and should have the power to freely enter into international relations with other states, and also have the ability to control and decide freely its own internal affairs. In view of this, Latapach suggested that Manchukuo, formerly Manchuria, a province of China, which was invaded by Japan, who granted independence to them a year later, was not a state because it did not satisfy this requirement. It was evident that most of its affairs, internal and international, were conducted by China. It was returned fully to China after the Second World War. Ghana also, before 1957, could not be regarded as a state because it was under the control of the British, with no capacity to enter into international relations with any other state on her own. This, however, is different from agreements voluntarily entered into by states themselves to permit some level of interference in their international affairs by other states. So far as that agreement does not place the state under the legal control of another state. With regard to this, Judge Anzilotti stated that as long as these restrictions do not place the state under the legal authority of another state, the former remains an independent state without, however extensive and burdensome some obligations may be. This was said in the Austro-German Customs Union case, the Customs Union case. Okay. For instance, some of Liechtenstein's foreign relations are conducted for it by Switzerland. The arrangement between India and Bhutan to guide Bhutan in some of its international relations is another. That was in the 1949 Treaty of Friendship between India and Bhutan. So these arrangements, however, do not affect the independence of the state. It was due to the absence of the independence requirement that the United Nations and the AU called upon states not to recognize Transkei, etc. Transkei and Bhutanstan as new states, since it was evidence that one at the time 90% of his budget was provided for by South Africa. Now, so we've talked about states as subject of international law. Now let's talk about international organizations. So the initial belief was that only states could be subject of international law, but it's no more the case. Now, international organizations qualify to be subject of international law, provided the said international organization, just as a state, satisfies certain conditions outlined in the reparations for injuries case. Now, there was no need to recognize them as such according to the ICJ in the reparations case due to the rights, duties, and powers possessed by these international organizations, especially the UN. Without such recognition, it would be very difficult for them to operate smoothly at the international plane. An international organization must satisfy the following criteria as a subject of international law, according to the opinion of the ICJ in the reparations for injuries case. So in the reparations for injuries case, these are the criteria. It must be a permanent association of states with lawful subjects equipped with organs. So hence the UN has organs such as the General Assembly, the Security Council, and also has a constitution, which is the UN Charter, so it can be a subject of international law. Two, there must be a distinction in terms of legal powers and purposes between the organization and its members. So the organization must have its own objectives and powers different from that of its member states. For instance, Article 1 of the United Nations Charter clearly states that the aim of the UN, which is to ensure world peace and ensure friendly relations and cooperation among member states, is different from the aims and objectives of member states such as Ghana or the United States. 3. There must be the existence of legal powers exercisable on the international plane and not solely within the national system of one or more states. So the following are evidence that shows an international organization has a legal capacity. 1. It has a treaty-making power. Example, in the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties between states and international organizations. 2. Has privileges and immunities for its members, assets, and headquarters. For instance, Article 105 of the United Nations Charter provides immunity for the United Nations and its officials in the territory of the member states. 3. Has capacity to espouse international claims. 4. Enjoys recognition from states. 5. Has its own responsibility, that is, obligations that are incurred in the name of the organization, cannot be shifted to the member states. For example, the International Think Council's appeal. It was stated that member states of the collapsed International Think Council cannot be made to pay for what the organization undertook in its own name. Hence, the international organization must be seen to have the capacity to face its own obligations in it occurs. In the reparation for injuries case, these are the facts of the case. Count Bernadotte, a Swedish national who was the chief UN truce negotiator, was killed allegedly by a private gang of terrorists in the new city of Jerusalem. The new city was then in Israel, or it was in Israeli possession and not Palestine. In the course of deciding what action to take in respect of his killing, the General Assembly sought the advice of the ICJ as to whether the United Nations had an international legal capacity or could be regarded as a subject of international law. The court held that the United Nations and all international organizations could be regarded as subjects of international law, subject to the conditions that we stated. Okay. And now, let's go to individuals as subjects of international law. As a general rule, individuals cannot bring international claims unless it is done on their behalf by their national state. For instance, with the ICJ, individuals lack capacity to bring claims before it. However, most treaties impose obligations on individuals and also give some rights and privileges to individuals. Examples are treaties prohibiting genocide, crimes against the peace, war crimes. Again, some treaties have given direct capacity to individuals to bring international claims against either their own states or other states for breaching an international obligation owed to them before other international courts or tribunals. For example, the European Convention on Human Rights, 1950. Also, the International Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. Investment treaties and others have given rights to individuals to bring claims before international courts and in tribunals. Whatever the case may be, whether or not a treaty does establish rights and duties as regards individuals will depend on the facts of the case and the intention of the parties. So, in the Nuremberg Tribunal, it was said that international law imposes duties and liabilities upon individuals as well as states. Reasons being that crimes against international law are committed by men, not by abstract entities, and only by punishing individuals who commit such crimes can provisions of international law be enforced. In any case, there have been many instances individuals have been made to face trial before international courts, like the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court. The trial of Saddam Hussein is an example. Let's go to sui generis, multinational corporations are subjects of international law. Now, there are corporations which operate in more than two countries. For example, Total or Shell, Barclays, another example. So these companies are established under the national laws of the country where they are located. However, in most cases, there are universal investment treaties that serve as a way of safeguarding the operations of these companies in various countries. For instance, Article 20 of the 1992 Constitution permits the government of Ghana to take over property of aliens. As such, to protect these companies against arbitrary use of such powers by states, states enter into treaty agreements to safeguard various corporations of its nationals that may be found in foreign states. These treaties may give capacity to these corporations to bring international claims and may also indicate forums where such disputes may be settled. Again, these companies have developed the practice of inserting in contractual agreements between themselves and states that their agreements be governed by international law, and also in case there is a dispute, it should be settled by an international court or tribunal and not the national court of the state. For example, in the Texaco and Libya case, the arbitrator agreed to act by indicating that it is the best mode to safeguard the interests of companies when they enter into contractual agreements with states. It was due to this recognition that enabled a corporation like Starrett Housing to bring a claim against the Republic of Iran for an alleged expropriation of its property by the Iranian government before an international company. That case is the Starrett Housing Corp and Iran. So this brings us to the end of subjects of international law. See you on the next podcast.